Thanks, counsel. We'll call our next case, PJM Power Providers Group et al. Versus FERC. Counsel?
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is John Shepard. I'm here on behalf of the PJM Power Providers Group and the Electric Power Supply Association. We've asked to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
That's done. And, you know, just right from the jump, let me say, we saw the concern about road. Are you really going to hold us to 15 minutes? You've seen what we can do in the way of asking questions about the difference between a baggie and a dollar bill. You can be assured you're going to have plenty of time to go through what you need to go through, because we got a lot of questions for you.
Thank you, Your Honor. We will hope to not exceed the record set in NJBPU in 2014.
Okay.
And on that note, as the court is doubtless aware, this case concerns a complete reversal in FERC precedent concerning the treatment of state subsidies in federally regulated capacity markets, specifically those held by PJM.
Yeah. Let's just jump into it, because you gave us a lot of paper. We've looked at a lot of paper.
Okay.
So we do have a lot of questions. This is our chance to have a conversation. So let me start with your most recent 28J letters. I miss the days in the district court when I could be completely selfish and didn't have colleagues to share time with, and I could also make lawyers stand up and say, okay, now you answer that point, instead of running the way we need to run these, which is...
But in those days, it was me who made Judge Jordan stand up.
That's true. Those were the good old days. So we'll be asking, or I'll at least be asking, some of these same questions to the other side. But on your most recent 28J letter, you wrote on January 5th, I believe it was, that there is now effectively a three-person commission.
With regard to this case, it's been, what's happened, Your Honor, is it's been reduced to two party split-wise, but because one of the, because the new acting chairman, Commissioner Phillips, has some recusal issues that in terms of the people who were able to vote on this order the first time around, it's back to two.
Well, you hit the very point. How certain is that recusal? Do we in fact have what is effectively a 2-to-1 a three-person commission, so that the most we would end up with, or the worst you get, is a 2-to-1 split? You would get a majority.
Your Honor, I cannot know the answer to that question, because it depends on what the acting chairman is going to do in terms of treating his own recusal.
Talk too quickly, please.
Yes, ma'am, I will slow down. Your Honor, I am not at all sure, and I think you should direct that question to FERC. We'll have better information about what the current acting chairman is thinking. The one thing I think I could point to by way of inference is that this case could have been resolved at any point if Commissioner Phillips was interested in declaring that he was not recused. They could have asked for a voluntary remand and voted this out 3-to-2, the same way that the first case that arose under 205G, the inventoried energy case in ISO New England, was held in abeyance because they expected Danley was about to become a commissioner.
You may have to slow down again.
Further? All right, I apologize, Your Honor. The major inference that I would draw from the fact the case has not, that FERC has never asked for a voluntary remand, is that Commissioner Phillips is either waiting for the outcome of this case to make a decision about recusal, or has never decided that he would ever be able to undo that. Otherwise, they could have taken the remand at any point and done it 3-2. I'm basing that off of the first case, Your Honor, which happened under 205G. It's called the inventoried energy case. It's about ICE New England. That was another split. They asked the court for abeyance because Commissioner Danley's nomination was pending. He was indeed confirmed. That allowed them to vote out the order. And then, as Your Honor is aware from the reply brief, that majority order also was vacated. I think that if FERC were able to take this case back in voluntary remand, that they would have done so. But I'm not privy to any of those discussions.
Doesn't the chairperson of FERC control litigation decisions? And so, if the chairperson is going to be recused, then kind of who makes litigation decisions?
They control the chairman of FERC controls litigation. Well, it's the chief administrative and executive officer and the five duties they has are unique to him are specified. And this falls into that category, the direction of personnel, but it's largely about setting the agenda And so is Your Honor's question, is there any way to make sure that, the case would be scheduled? Because the number one issue with the vacate and remand is that the FPA and the other FERC statutes don't have a time limit on when FERC can act on remand. And so it is not uncommon for FERC to sit on remand orders and vacature orders for years before they issue.
There's two types of remand generally. There's remand where a court divests itself of jurisdiction and remand where a court retains jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor.
During the pendency of remand, if the court were to say—
Your Honor, we would be delighted if you vacated this case and then chose to continue exercising jurisdiction in order to ensure that a timely order and remand came out. That would be a delight to us. Please do so.
Well, do we have the power to do that? I mean, we're just trying to deal with some practical things here.
Understand.
We're going to end up talking about the legal issues that have been teed up in the briefing. But frankly, this case has got so many difficult administrative law issues and some constitutional concerns, I guess we can get into, that nobody's really tackled, that it would be, all of which would be obviated if the body acted, the commission acted with a majority. So do we have the power, do we even have the power to punt this back? Can we,
Your Honor, I don't understand your—
What would be the legal rationale? Is there a legal rationale for us to say, not the practical one, because I understand the practical one, is there a legal rationale for us to say as a court, guess what? This fight is over action versus inaction, whether the commission can act by a split in this fashion, whether or not there's a rationale that's expressed when the body hasn't acted as a whole by majority vote. All those things go away, take it back, and now do it with the majority. Is there a legal rationale for us to do that, or is that just it would be nice to do it, but there's no way for us to do it?
You do not have the authority to tell FERC that it must no longer be in deadlock. That case, a case very similar to that has already been decided. It's cited by FERC last night in their 28J letter. Unfortunately, that utterly misapprehends the relief we want from the court, but I don't think—
And you misapprehended my question.
Okay.
It's not telling them you must act. Mm-hmm. It's telling them, hey, there's a whole lot of problem with what you did. Now, why don't you take another look at it? Because it's no longer a circumstance where a deadlock is certain. It's on the contrary, a circumstance where a majority vote is certain because there's an odd number of people who can act.
I understand your question, Your Honor, but you asked one question about whether or not you have the power to do something, and then they're asking another question about practicality. If this were an actual order, then of course you'd have the power to vacate and remand. The fact that it is something less than an actual order can't possibly give you any less power about whether or not to remand.
Can it be something less than an actual order under the terms of the statute?
Yeah, you're taking us right into the merits, and that's not— And we'll get there.
I wanted to get to the practical part of your question, which is to say, I don't think practicalities can fall into it. I think it would be a terribly perilous thing. That's what we discussed in our reply brief. I don't think courts should be making decisions based on speculation about what the composition of the commission is going to be at any particular time, whether it's now or 6 months from now. It's been entirely too
fluid.
Whether
206 supersedes 205.
I wouldn't say, Your Honor, that 206 supersedes 205. I would say our argument is instead that 205 never voted out, can't possibly exceed a 206. That's a bit different.
Your letter, I'm asking questions based on your letter.
I understand,
Mr. Shepherd. Your letter says, hey, there's this redressability issue isn't this change addresses the redressability and standing problem
right.
That FERC has been pointing to. Look at this. So I'm not sure how you can say to us in one breath, hey, look at this, it's important and bears on the issues. And then the next breath say to us, it's a big mistake for the court to be paying attention to the composition of FERC at any given moment in time.
But for FERC's meritless argument that remand is futile, there would have been no reason for us to say that. But one of their chief lead arguments was, what's that?
But you did say it, so.
And redressability is a very important element of standing.
Sure.
So Should we be paying attention to what you said on January 5th, or should we be paying attention to what FERC said on January 9th when it said there's still a redressability problem?
Well,
it seems like you're making their argument for them, which is don't pay attention to what the composition of the FERC is at any given time.
No, I think that what they were silently doing was, and they can answer this question for their own, I think they were abandoning the futility argument, which was, I think, an embarrassing argument to make, but they instead shifted to a completely different futility argument, which is asking this court to deny relief we haven't requested, which they posited as the relief that we want is for you to order FERC to break a deadlock, which no one has ever asked you to do. Be very precise about the next sentence right before you asked your first question was going to be the relief that we request. The relief that we want is very precise. We would like the court to hold that FERC has not lawfully changed the rate previously in effect as set by FERC and imposed on PJM under FPA Section 206. That is the relief that we're seeking. And if that is granted, then we will get prospective relief for sure, and we can have a path for retroactive relief.
Yeah. No doubt. If we give you what you win, by definition, you
win.
But
how do you have standing to be before us in the first place?
That's what I thought I was answering, was the question of why this is redressable. Because the thing that we're asking for is that. And if we get that, we will achieve redress.
And what is your injury?
Our injury in the past or our injury going forward? Because an order from this court definitely solves our injury going forward because it returns us back to the status quo ante. In terms of backcasting injuries, you know, FERC is going to give people a lot of trouble about trying to collect money from an auction that was held under rules that were held to be illegal. We've been to this rodeo with them before, but that case is not for you. The absolute minimum we get in the event that we prevail in the relief we're actually asking for is that we get the ability to have prospective relief. And if FERC wants to reimpose this nonsense we're living under now, they can do that through a lawfully issued order.
Well,
how can we, if we judge the order rather than the content, how can we reimpose an order which has been a ruling which has been superseded by the narrow MOPR? I mean, are you saying we ought to go back?
No, there is always, Your Honor, there must always be a filed rate in effect in order to transact business. If you don't have a filed rate in effect, you can't have a transaction, period. So there is always a filed rate in effect. The filed rate in effect prior to the Secretary's notice was a rate set by FERC over the course of 4 years of litigation. And imposing them under 406. That was the rate in effect. The rate that got, and the express purpose of this 205 filing was to overturn the rate set by FERC in 206, as well as going even further and reaching all the way back to the orders issued in 2011 and beyond that this court affirmed.
Well, then you want to get into the merits. Just get into the merits. How can it be that in the teeth of 313B, congressional enactment saying, a deadlock will give legal effect to PJM's proposed tariff. How can you say that is not, that's not the result that obtains as a matter of law?
No, Your Honor, I think that with respect, the way that you have paraphrased what Section 205GA1 is written is not correct. If Congress wanted to say, it shall be an order, which is a phrase you will find often, that would be the end of it. But that's not. The court in Congress goes out of its way to say it shall be considered to be an order for purposes of rehearing. And you need to tell that. You need to say which direction you're going to go, because otherwise no one knows whose ox is going to be gored and no one knows who's got the burden of going forward with rehearing. It doesn't say that it is an order, Your Honor.
Well, it appears to say that it indeed is an order so that you can have some kind of judicial review. I mean,
Your Honor, the
purpose of this not to get past public citizen?
No, it's absolutely the purpose was to get past public citizen. And the purpose of public citizen, Your Honor, was to make sure that what FERC is now asking for doesn't happen, which is that you have a split and the rate goes into effect by operation of law. That was the purpose of the statute.
Isn't that what the statute says?
No, what the statute says is it's subject to judicial review. I think the best way to articulate what Congress did, which I want to be really clear, I personally opposed and FERC as an institution opposed the adoption of this rather strange statute, because what they're really trying to accomplish here, to use a different nomenclature, is to try to make inaction reviewable. Now, there are contexts in which agency inaction is reviewable.
We've read it. I know your inaction argument. I want you to respond to their argument, which is your position makes a nullity of the statute.
No.
That your assertion is that the commission can only act by a majority vote, and that the statute is designed expressly to say, no, that's not true. When there's a deadlock, that rate will move through, and that's reviewable. It's reviewable by a court, but that's what's going to happen. So go ahead and answer that argument, that the statute was designed to do it, it meant to do it, it in fact did do it. You might not like it, but it did it.
I think, Your Honor, what it did was it made sure, this is the argument we present in one in our reply brief, the purpose of the statute was to ensure that you don't end up with a final, no longer appealable order as the result of an inaction because of a tie. What this statute does do is it preserves everyone's rights as they were. It does not change the status quo, and the result that is desired by the filer does not obtain.
How can it not change the status quo? By definition,
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I should say the status quo ante is what I meant.
PJM is doing something. You wouldn't be having FERC act if there weren't something being brought before it. So something is being brought before it,
right.
and that thing is going to change what was before, right? I mean, nobody comes to FERC and says, whatever you do, don't do anything. Leave it all the same.
Right.
They come in because they want something different. They ask for something different. Because of the composition of the body, there's a deadlock.
Yep.
Does the statute not say, in that circumstance, that new thing, that different thing, that's the new operative order?
It says, for purposes of seeking rehearing, we're going to tell you which side is going to be seeking rehearing. And it tells you that eventually you will get judicial review if there's no resolution on rehearing.
And judicial review of what? Because you're positing that nothing happened. There's, by your lights, there's nothing that's in the world that's different. We should still be operating over the expanded.
Your Honor, we absolutely agree that there is no rationale for this court to review. There's two things you usually look for, right? You look for an effect, and you look for a rationale.
Yeah, we're just kind of talking past each other.
I'm doing my best.
Slow down to a stop for a minute.
Okay.
What does the statute do? And please don't repeat, all it does is tell you who gets to do review. Unless you really believe that that's the only thing that it does, that does nothing else, which would be an interesting position, because then it appears you're saying there's really nothing for us to review because it didn't change anything. So what does the statute do? What does the statute do if it does not say, by operation of law, the thing that got asked for by PJM is going to kick in because there was the deadlock? What is it? You're saying it doesn't say that. It doesn't mean that. If I understood you, that it doesn't mean what I just said.
I think if we failed to seek rehearing, it definitely would take effect by operation of law. And I think
that's the difference between an order and a final order.
Right. I think there's an important piece of context that probably needs to be added here about why the statute wasn't thoroughly irrational, even if it's badly organized. When the statute was enacted in October 2018, FERC had a long-established practice of issuing what are called tolling orders, which effectively allowed them to extend their rehearing period indefinitely. The D.C. Circuit put that to an end last spring in an on-bank decision. And so now you don't just have to get past the first order and then it's okay, we can wait. We'll wait until we have a fully formed commission. We'll wait until somebody dies or changes their mind. And at that point, we'll be able to issue a final order that a court can then review. And that's all right, because the rate making is still prospective. It's all been in one proceeding. Everyone has notice of what's going on. No one's rights have been finally fixed yet. I think that may have been what Congressman Kennedy had in mind. I think it would have satisfied the major gripe in response to Public Citizen, which was just there was a cram down and no one could say anything. We get the opportunity to seek rehearing. There's absolutely no answer whatsoever on rehearing, and that is an independent APA violation. So what we have happening here is a filing.
Well, it's no longer an independent APA violation because the statute was enacted. And the statute 205 supersedes the APA.
I've not heard anyone suggest before, Your Honor, that the FPA section 205, which was enacted before, or more narrowly 205G enacted 5G. After the APA, changed anything about the APA.
Doesn't the specific outrank the general?
Yeah, the specific does outrank the general, but here one would expect if the APA says as it does that it governs all of these proceedings.
So
if you were enacting 205G, you would have to specifically say, and the APA no longer applies.
You're saying because of the APA, the statute's a nullity in the first place?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying that trying to take binding action through a 2-2 vote is a nullity. If you can't ever meet the APA requirements, it's exactly what Commissioner Danley testified when it was originally out.
You know, this is like kabuki. It's a formalized dance. You're an experienced lawyer. You know it. You got to stop talking when one of us starts talking, because otherwise it doesn't work. So
right.
I know you want to get you want to get whatever you want to say out, but you got to stop if one of us starts talking. So go ahead and ask your question, Judge Roth.
Okay, I thought. That you are saying that the APA requires a ration examination, and that the statute 205G is an nullity, but 205G says that the statements of the commissioners are something that we can review, and that there is as there was prior. To 205G in an order when you had a majority, that there is something there for us to consider as the reasoning of FERC, and that when there is a tie vote, we should proceed, and this will be considered to be an order issued by the commission, and we can go forward with that. And that the APA does not, in its general terms, overrule the specific provision of 205G.
Okay. Your Honor, if the FERC had issued an order with a majority, we would still be contesting this. And if we were still contesting this and it were an order, we would have filed a very similar looking rehearing request, minus all the stuff about 205G. We'd just be having a straightforward, typical FERC argument about whether or not FERC's rationale and its orders made any sense.
And so in light of your explanation, it seems that there's really kind of like just two parts of this case.
There's
what is 205G?
Yes.
And how does it operate in the context of the Section 205, the Section 206, everything like that? And the other one is like, look, do we have either something close to reasoned decision making or just and reasonable? Right. That's how at least I'm seeing the case. So I've got a couple questions for you about kind of 205G. I know you didn't cite seal a law in I think your brief. It might have been another blue brief.
An amicus brief brought it up.
But I guess, you know, that's an interesting case because it basically says when we see something that we've really never seen before in administrative law, a single-headed independent agency, you know, there's trouble. Mm-hmm. And so what we've got here is kind of like a deadlock, not an FEC deadlock, which is deadlock by design, right? But we have deadlock kind of workaround. As far as I can tell, we haven't seen this ever before. See, la la, we've got an instance of something we've never, ever seen before. And so I guess my question is, when do we get to the point that we just say, hey, that legislation's too much. And I'll give you an extreme hypothetical just to get things, you know, moving. Let's just say FERC, Congress expanded FERC out to, let's say, 19 members. Okay. And it said, vote however you want. But if one member, so little as one member, votes for a rate change, a 205 sort of, you know, rate revision, that becomes the order of FERC, regardless of majority vote, regardless of everything else like this. Would we just sit there and say, that's the statute. Let's not think about any constitutional things. Let's not think about what sort of strange bird this is. That's the statute.
let's go apply it, and they got the one vote, therefore, that's the order. We'll read the order maybe of that commissioner, the rationale of that one commissioner, and then we'll consider everything else. In that instance, I mean, I guess at one level, if that's constitutional, then a deadlock review to judicial review is pretty easily constitutional. But I guess my thought is, do you have any thoughts on kind of this unusual nature of 205G in the sense that I'm not familiar with too many other statutes that go deadlock carries rate with formal force of law into action upon final order status and makes it judicially reviewable? And if there's nothing else like that, then shouldn't we be really thinking more like, why is this the first time it happened? I mean, that's what Chief Justice Roberts, who's doing seal of law, he goes, this has never happened before, other than maybe the Office of Special Counsel. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, this is definitely the first time this has come to a court. It's not the first time it happened since the statute was enacted. Again, we're not in favor of the structure. It seemed highly unworkable. And the most unworkable part is exactly what we're confronting here.
And isn't
there was a massive...
The appropriate remedy, if you don't like the statute, is to go to Congress.
Yes, ma'am. That is, if we wanted to change the statute, but yeah. we're trying to decide this statute and how we're going to apply it here. And the problem here is that nothing in 205G says ignore the APA.
So I mean, just back to my question. I gave you an invitation to basically say, treat the statute like a nullity. Yeah. I think you declined the invitation. And so
I just didn't get a chance to answer your question.
Okay. Then please.
I did want to begin by saying this is really two completely separate cases. You have one set of issues that's entirely about how we're going to implement this unusual statute to choose a charitable word. And then you have the usual things that we would do, even if it were an order. So we don't have to worry about getting entirely spin out about whether this is an order or not an order, because it's not going to satisfy APA review anyway. It's not going to satisfy. There's nothing in the statute that says suspend APA review. No. A1B says, and now proceed to judicial review. And if you're proceeding to judicial review and you have a piece of paper that says there was a tie, completely changing for policy with zero explanation, that's a pretty core violation of the
statute. Then you always will overrule it, right? By that reasoning, you can never, ever give effect to the deadlock, which the statute says you should give effect to it as an order. I mean, is there any way that you would ever not turn it around based on what you just said? And when I say turn it around, is there any way you would ever say...
It's always unconstitutional supply.
It's always bad. It's not even unconstitutional. The way you're framing it is,
it's always APA.
By the statute, by the terms of the APA, it's always bad.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we warned Congress about. And the answer that we got in the legislative history was, well, we're going to have these opinions, and that should help people to facilitate. And eventually, when they get around to issuing a rehearing order, there will eventually be an order.
Then answer Judge Roth's question of, doesn't the specific overrule the general? Because what you're saying is, as a general matter, the APA requires a reasoned decision from the agency in order to be lawful. And here it seems Congress is saying, no, you don't have to have that. You don't have to have anything except just what you're saying, which is a deadlock, and then the proposed PJM rate goes into operation.
With explanatory letters.
Well, I think the background rule that I think that Congress had in mind here, I think this might be helpful, is that when you go back to the mobile cases, looking at, okay, what is it that we're supposed to do in a situation where there is no action? And the answer was, well, it says they've got 60 days notice, and so your options are reject or accept. So there's long been this idea that it'll go into effect by operation of law if there's no protest. So FERC overwhelmingly, the overwhelming majority of FERC actions take place in the form of disposals of unprotested filings that people get to issue with letter orders. Then we have another group, and FERC has almost uniformly, I think nine times ever, allowed a 205 to go into effect with like some form of order. You either get a letter order or you get this other one. And of course, you're aware, public citizen then erupted into this big question, what do you do when you have this tie? I think that Congressman Kennedy, whose constituents were very, very angry that there was a huge rise in the price of capacity in ICE New England, which is why it's called the Fair, you know, the Fair Rates Act, and even though having to deal with anything about procedure, would not be happy with a result where you still get a 2-2 split and it still goes into effect.
Well, let me propose this. You know, Judge Roth is talking about, I think, a pretty canonical point, which is that the specific controls the general, mm-hmm. right? And so the APA speaks, you know, 706 is all about agency action subject to review. 551 talks about the definition of agency. The definition of agency is defined as an authority of the United States. Sometimes an authority is a body. Sometimes it might be a person. If a person, that's what the Senate legislative history for the APA seems to suggest. So if each commissioner were an agency, and the agency also has that got the Supreme Court's a lot of its attention, what set aside means. So this is all background. But why shouldn't we just vote? Why shouldn't we just examine each separate statement of the FERC commissioners, review them for arbitrary and capricious review or just and reasonable review? If any of them fail either of those standards, we set them aside, and then we tally the votes. So we might not be, so we don't get to 2-2 until we know that we have legitimate agency action, action that's just and reasonable or arbitrary and capricious. And so it seems like you're positing at the outset that we've got a 2-2 tie and then saying, hey, don't go back and look at them. I'm proposing maybe reversing that order, saying it's two issues, right? We all agree it's two issues. Do the second one first. Go see whose decisions work and whose don't. Maybe one in your favor would be stricken as unjust or unreasonable or arbitrary and capricious. Maybe one that votes against you would be stricken as unjust or unreasonable. But until we do that, until we examine each statement that each commissioner has signed on to, including the joint statement, do we really know that we've got a 2-2 tie? Because the APA speaks of set aside. And set aside, whether it means vacatur and remand or vacatur or remand, doesn't it set aside mean that someone's vote wouldn't count anymore? Hence, we could avoid deadlock that way. And I guess what I'm proposing is, instead of arguments 1 and 2, shouldn't it be arguments 2 and 1?
Your Honor, I'm not. There are quite a number of leaps that have to happen to get there.
Okay.
I think what you're trying to do is sort of make the statute make sense. If what you're trying to do is perhaps to reach affirmance, but here are some of the challenges. No,
What I'm trying to do is remember where this starts. You were asked a number of questions by the panel about the specific controlling the general. The one thing about the specific that's really interesting to me that you don't see in every statute is that it requires statements by each commissioner. The one area of opening that we see in the APA is that each commissioner might independently, given the powers that they have, constitute an agency for purposes of making agency action. And so what I'm saying is, if those two fit together hand in glove, then the first step, before we worry if this is even 2-2, is that we've got separate statements and we should review each statement separately and then find out, what do we have? Do we have a deadlock or not? So that's what I said last time, but I just want to tell you why I said
that. I do not think that it's possible to turn a statement by a commissioner into any higher dignity in the record than anything else that's filed. What it says is that it be entered into the record. It doesn't say it has any more or less dignity than anything else in the record. So I think it's the first struggle is to develop an entire new theory of jurisprudence under which individual commissioners are kind of their own, like, independent sub-agencies, kind of like the United States of FERC, and each state's got its own
definition. Of 551 says authority of the United States. Yes. And if each commissioner has authority by virtue of being in the United States, such they can still satisfy Humphrey's executor to be the exercise of executive authority of the United States to be an independent agency, then maybe they meet it. The Senate legislative history, which, you know, isn't the greatest go by, suggests
that agency can be body or, in some instances, person.
Here you're talking about the APAs.
Yeah, the APAs.
Right.
Because, like, sometimes an independent counsel might be a person, not an agency,
right.
But they might be subject to the APA. I don't think we'd say that independent counsel are just immune from APA. I think we'd say they still are their person. And what I'm saying is, to the extent that an independent counsel might be considered an agency, then perhaps also each commissioner, for purposes of what this FERC statute says, brings us into a kind of a combo space where we reconcile the specific with the general before we count votes.
Yeah, would you warn us off that or not?
I would very much warn you off of that. I was trying to architect the most polite way to say that I think that would be an incredibly bad idea. But yes, I would warn you off. I think it would require quite a series of pretty large leaps. But as long as you've shown an interest in looking at legislative history, Judge Phipps, let's look at the legislative history about what these statements were supposed to be here. When challenged about what it is that they're supposed to be here, the answer was, well, we're going to put them in the record, and it's going to create fodder for people to find a negotiating path. The discipline of going through the writing down, actually sitting down and writing down what it is that you're thinking, that's going to help crystallize everyone's opinion, and we're going to get there. And then, by the way, we might not be deciding this in a rehearing for the next 18 years, or that's hyperbole, 2 or 3 years, and so we'll get that down later.
We're going to keep you up here. You've been up here a long time. We know it. Everybody else wants to talk. But when I said we had a lot of questions and you weren't going to have to worry about time, I meant it.
We know you're having lots of fun.
Yeah. So here's something that doesn't really seem to have been addressed by the parties in any way, but which seems to be lurking in the background, which is, this statute's just not even constitutional. This statute is unworkable, and it's by definition unworkable because it purports to give to the agency the power to act when it can't act because by definition it's in deadlock. And when it purports to give that power, what it does is exacerbating a delegation problem because it doesn't just delegate to the agency, it delegates past the agency to a body like PJM, and then PJM's desire acquires the force of law. And that's a delegation twice removed, nothing that the Constitution can possibly countenance. You should strike the whole thing down. Now, I don't know if that's what was meant to be lurking in the background, but it seems to me that the arguments that have been made are pushing in that direction. It can't be, you can't let this agency act by inaction. That's wrong. Well, that seems to be what the statute says. Then there's a problem with the statute. Is your position, hey, if the statute does give the power to the agency to do this, if it is action, not inaction, then the statute can't stand? Or is there a saving reading for the statute that would give us constitutional avoidance, even if we thought the statute had difficulty? Yeah, and I think Judge Phipps's questions to you are, in that vein, is there some saving way to look at this thing, or do we have to go to the constitutional issue, which frankly nobody is faced up to, but which I will repeat appears to be in the background of much of what's being put to us, which is this statute can't work. It just can't work.
I think, Your Honor, you've just demonstrated the wisdom of having journalist judges. You're faced with a whole battery of FERC nerds, or professionally for several decades, and unlike what Judge Phipps was positing about looking at the legislative history of the APA and trying to figure out what set-aside means and maybe find a way to balkanize the different petitioners, I think that what you've just said sounds very sensible and legally durable. In all candor, I have to say we never made that argument, and I think that it should weigh on you that we didn't. I don't know if you're allowed to independently raise it.
It does weigh on me, which is why I'm articulating it right now, because far be it from me to say, I think what they really meant was, this is unconstitutional.
I believe that our attention was focused on the the public citizen line about this is a universally accepted majority rule principle, FEC, deadlock by design, notwithstanding, that this is an extremely bizarre thing. But you know, we had many more things to argue about. And
give a coherent theory of unconstitutionality of 205G.
No, I
you don't.
I just
and so,
said
and,
that I did.
You don't. And so it might have a little non-delegation problem. It might have a little seal of law problem. It might have a little PCOB problem. I don't know. But you don't give a coherent theory. You give nothing in that regard. And so isn't it up to us to create kind of, before we just kind of say that the statute's unconstitutional, we have to construe it in a way that you might think, in your own words, is an extremely bad idea, but you've hated the legislation from the outset. And so isn't it up to us at one level to give it a meaning that we think would be within the bounds of a constitutional construction, albeit one that you still don't like, but one that we would say would satisfy the outer bounds of the Constitution before breaking kind of that precious glass and declaring 205G unconstitutional for no coherent theory that you've provided?
Your Honor, we didn't make the argument, and I can only note that fact. But if you find that it's within your power to analyze the case that way, well, then please do.
We got power. At a certain point, our power stops because we're no longer construing; we're legislating, right? I mean, there's a range within which we have to operate, and we know that.
Yes.
We're pressing to try to get answers to this, but because this is a mess. And
I don't think we can rule on the constitutionality until you people have had a chance to brief it if you want to raise it. But it hasn't been raised.
Right. So
would you like to ask us to engage in special briefing this subject? I'm at your disposal.
Well, we're gonna hear from other people, and then maybe we will indeed ask for something like that. But you've done yeoman's work there, Mr. Shepherd. Thank you for answering question after question after question. We'll go ahead and let you have a seat, even if you never got to anything you wanted to speak about. I'll bet you all really wish you were in the D.C. Circuit right now, but I promise you, not as much as we wish you were in the D.C. Circuit right now.
Your Honor, that was the way the AJBU case began. It was the intentional infliction of emotional distress.
Right on. Okay, we'll hear from Chris Brown, I believe, is up next.
Your Honors, may it please the Court. I'm Chris Brown. I'm arguing on behalf of the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission and the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. I had stuff planned out. I want to point out that it's our position that FERC's deemed approval of the minimum offer price rule is arbitrary and capricious and contrary to law, and that's a key point. Accordingly, it should be vacated and remanded. To get to your points, your questions about how to deal with this, one theory we have is it's an order that's reviewable. You know, the record below is reviewable by this court. And like the case in Amador v. Salazar, where the D.C. Circuit reviewed a Indian Gaming Regulation Act,
right,
where there was no decision, and that court said it couldn't review it necessarily under the APA arbitrary or capricious, but it could review it because there was a contrary law.
Right, and your pitch in your briefing is we should give it de novo review, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, how could we possibly do that, Mr. Brown? This is not like a circumstance where we're going to give de novo review to a determination about what a compact means between the states or what a contract means or something like that. This is not legal language. This is a complex set of policy determinations, the weighing of different options. How would we do this without turning ourselves into something that would be even more frightening than us pretending to be the D.C. Circuit, which is pretending to be FERC commissioners, where we're we're weighing all this stuff out, and we're saying, you know what, on de novo review, it looks to us like the expanded MOPR is better than narrow MOPR.
It's where Judge Phipps was going. You look at the entire record, including the statements, which are not the decision or fact-finding, but they are instructive for the court to determine whether this minimum offer price rule meets its purpose of restricting and identifying and mitigating buyer-side market power.
Well, the question is, isn't the question more particularly whether it meets FERC's responsibility to see that there are just and reasonable tariffs?
Yes.
Okay. So I put it to you again. How can we make that judgment? How can we de novo make that judgment? I mean, the whole apparatus of American administrative law is set up with the notion that there are some areas that judges just can't really get into effectively. You need expertise and you need a capacity to weigh different competing interests and constraints and come up with your best judgment. And then acting on behalf of the United States government, you, the agency, do that and you give your rationale for it. And then the court has a very light touch and says, well, you know what, that's not arbitrary and capricious. It isn't what I would have done, but you're good. How do we, in the face of the grand structure of administrative law in the United States, say, now we're going to get the de novo review to one of the most complex weighing of pros and cons it can be possibly imagined, which is energy regulation in the United States of America?
Well, one possible way is to vacate it and remand it back to FERC.
Great.
To do its...
How do we do that? So that's the question that I put to Mr. Shepard. Can we do that? Do we have the power to do that? Now it appears there may be an agency configured in a way that would allow us to say, you know what, take it back and don't give us a deadlock, give us a majority position. Do we have the power to do that? And if we did have the power to do it, what would be the legal rationale for sending it back instead of just saying, I don't want to mess with that? Like, that may be the secret feeling, but it's not a legally sound approach, and we want to hold ourselves to legally sound approaches and not what's convenient for us.
Well, you'll have to review the record and the statements by the commissioners and make a determination.
A determination of what? Are you now arguing for Judge Phipps's position, which is look and see whether each individual commissioner has acted arbitrarily and capriciously?
No, I'm looking at what the minimum offer, the actual tariff says, and determining whether it's just and reasonable.
Okay, so you are asking us to become FERC. That's the position you're taking, which is we should decide whether it's just and reasonable. Okay.
So how do you have standing to come before us and ask that?
Well, we have standing, both Pennsylvania and Ohio have restructured their electric markets such that we don't regulate generation by cost of service regulation as a public utility. We rely on the markets, specifically the capacity market, to ensure there's enough reliability to serve load. And in conjunction with the energy and ancillary services market, ensure that there are just and reasonable rates, retail rates, for our customers when they're buying generation. So with an improperly functioning, unjust and unreasonable tariff that does not set just and reasonable rates, our constituents, our ratepayers, are harmed in that. So that's the harm.
So the harm to the ratepayers is the harm to you?
As the regulator, yes. And we have statutory authority to, Ohio has statutory authority specifically under ORC 492802 to ensure retail electric service customers protection against unreasonable sales practices, market deficiencies, and market power. And Pennsylvania also has a section of reviewing market power, and we have authority to participate in FERC proceedings on behalf of
And how about redressability?
Again, redressability is because, like I said before, the remand, it should be remanded, vacated and remanded, because this tariff, it's our position that this tariff is unjust and unreasonable.
So let me just pick up on that. On you know, a big point of administrative law
Supreme Court issues like these big decisions everyone reads, like Citizens to Preserve Overton Park and stuff like this, they talk about, look, we're going to evaluate things based on the whole record, right? And it's a big mistake if an agency doesn't consider the whole record and stuff like this. And Congress added, though, in G1B, each commissioner shall add to the record of the commission a written statement. And so is it your position that when we look to evaluate unjust and unreasonable, that we look to the whole record? I assume the answer to that's yes. But then the next question is, does the whole record include the statements of each individual commissioner?
It is our position it does include the statements of the position of the record.
And so we have to engage in some review,
yes,
of each commissioner's statement.
Yes.
Right? Otherwise, like we aren't reviewing the whole record.
Correct.
Okay.
To what end? What do we do as we review them? What's the purpose?
Again, to make a determination of whether that's just and reasonable.
Let's tease out. Let's just say that we look at one commissioner's statement and say, no way. You know, voting for or against the adoption of the right, no way. That is just not just and reasonable, or that's arbitrary and capricious. The reasoned explanation, you know, didn't account for alliance interest. Just pull one of the reasons that things fail, arbitrary and capricious review. Let's say one of the commissioner's statements is deficient in that regard. Do we say it doesn't matter because it was still a 2-2 tie? Or is there some consequence to that? If we're supposed to review each one, and one of them is deficient, Judge Roth is pressing you on redressability, redressability, redressability. And if there's no consequence for one of the being deficient, then where are we?
You give it
maybe
less
it's
weight.
Not redressable.
You give it less weight than the other.
So we should give some weight to unjust and unreasonable commissioner statements? Just less? Like what? Less than one? Or less persuasive power, because we aren't really in a persuasive space, we're in a vote counting space.
It's sort of like evidence, when you weigh the evidence to see which one's persuasive.
Getting
so, so we're supposed to look at a 2-2 tie and then decide which one is more persuasive. We're supposed to look at these two and say, okay, it's a tie. Now we're going to adjudicate the tie based on who gives better reasons? Is that what you're saying?
Based on the record, yes.
Getting back to my questions on redressability, you were saying that redressability would be in having the ability to send this case back. So you're saying that included in redressability then would be a finding by this court that 205G1 is ineffective or is not to be considered an order of the commission of FERC.
Well, it's considered an order for review by the court. And so if you vacate and remand, then the redressability is that unjust and unreasonable rate would not go into
effect. In order to vacate and remand, though, we've got to say that the statute doesn't mean what it says, or the statute can't mean what it says.
It can't mean what it says.
So at the end of the day, your redressability pitch is sending it back in itself is redress. Making FERC take another run at it is redress.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Vacating it and remanding, yes.
Is a redress. All right. Well, I think we've got an intervener to hear from on the petitioner side.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Denise Goulet. I have the honor.
Can you keep your voice up, please?
Yes. My name is Denise Goulet, and I have the honor to represent the Office of the Ohio Consumers Council. We are one of the state agencies like the PUCO that was represented by Mr. Ross, but we represent solely consumers. And we do believe consumers are adversely affected. We pay these bills, and we depend upon competitive markets that are run by PJM and that are overseen by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And if FERC is not doing its job to make sure that those markets are going to have competitive outcomes, then there is redressability, that this case can be sent back to FERC to get them to try again. And that's the problem that we have.
On what basis? I put to you the question I put to Mr. Shepherd and Mr. Brown. What would be the legal rationale for us saying, you know what, we don't have to look at all these challenging issues you've teed up with this deadlock, because now you're configured in a way where you would have the capacity to produce something that would be irrefutably agency action. Take it back and do it again. On what basis would we say we what's the legal rationale for doing that? Do you have one?
I hope so. The statute, when it says that it gives the parties a right to appeal for purposes of Section 313 of the Federal Power Act, which is the right to appeal. So what the statute says is we're going to treat inaction as though it's an order so you can appeal. Once you appeal and it gets here, the question is, what's before this court? What's before this court is a FERC inaction. You've got a case that went into effect, and
Then what you're saying is exactly what Mr. Shepherd is saying. Is that right? You're saying it can't be agency action because, by definition, a deadlock means inaction. Is that what you're getting at?
I think what the statute means is that you are the only thing you can do is send it back to the FERC, because otherwise.
So what are you suggesting then? Ms. Goulet, that the statute is designed to create a loop where, as long as there's deadlock, it comes to us and we send it back, and it comes to us and we send it back, and it comes to us and we send it back, and that keeps happening until the configuration of FERC changes or one of us dies or something happens.
We should call it the Groundhog Day Act instead of
the Groundhog Day.
Isn't that
Your Honor,
the effect of what you're saying?
When I read the legislative material behind the statute, what it seemed to me was that not that the legislature, the Congress, was saying that you have to look at those commissioner statements as though they were the commission's order, because I don't think you can do that. And the statute doesn't say that. It just says that the commissioners will issue these statements. It's part of the record. And that these statements then, when you look at the legislative history, it looks like what the statements are intended to do was not so much to help this court, but to help FERC when it comes back to them
I'm not being fanciful. I want you to answer this question. Is your legal position that this statute creates a circumstance where, by definition, deadlock means inaction, we have review, and because there's inaction, we must send it back? And it's just going to keep ping-ponging until something changes. Is that the position you're taking?
Yes, and that's the hope that something will happen the first time it pings on back to FERC. That's the only way I can read the statute.
It was designed as a way to create frustration until gridlock ends. Frustration until gridlock ends.
Like
is that
voting
it?
For speaker.
Yes,
finally
but
on the 15th vote.
I would like to note, though, that a dramatic change in the rule of how these markets set prices. Remember, FERC's jurisdiction is to set just and reasonable prices, and there's a dramatic change that occurred in how that process set.
You don't have to persuade us that something big happened here, right? We read this. We understand there was a change in administration. There was effectively a 180 in the way people were looking at things. We get all that. Speak for myself. We're just trying to figure out the plumbing, because what I hear people saying is it's not working. And we're here to try to figure out the plumbing and not to say, well, this is a beautifully designed thing or not. But okay.
So the statute is what the statute says, and all we can do until it is determined that it's unconstitutional or it is constitutional and there is some way forward. All we can
nobody's,
do is play
nobody's
with
made
what
a constitutional
are.
Argument to us, which is a matter of some oddity to me, which is why I think we may end up asking for something from y'all. But I appreciate your argument, Ms. Galea. I know you didn't have very much time, but we've been at this for a while, and we need to hear from the FERC folks right now.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Jared Fish for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Believe it or not, I'm going to try to make your job easy, and I think it can certainly be easier than how the statute might appear at first blush. First, Judge Jordan, I think you hit the nail on the head in asking what is the legal rationale for vacating and remanding. And I'd like to go through why each of the three parties you just heard from cannot meet the redressability requirement, because this is not a dispute that can be judicially resolved. What they are arguing is that there is an administrative solution. Yes, that perhaps on remand, there could be a majority of commissioners who vote yay or nay on the focus MOPR. So yes, there is an administrative solution, potentially, for sure. But whether this dispute is capable of judicial resolution is a different matter. And because P3 and EPSA's whole theory of the case is that there can only be a judicially reviewable order if it's majority voted, then you would have to find that the remedy you can provide is ordering the commission to issue a majority voted order. And that's not
why would we have to do that? Why couldn't we simply say we don't agree with your assertion that the agency can only act by majority vote? We don't even have to answer that question. There's no need for us to answer that question. You've stated an injury in fact, and I believe you even conceded that they've stated an injury in fact. Your whole standing argument rests on redressability. Why isn't remand all by itself a redress? Something that says this will go back and FERC will have another chance to look at this and to explain itself and to do something. And that's what you're entitled to, and you're not entitled to anything more than that.
Your Honor, I don't know of a case where the court can just punt and send the case back in the hopes that maybe the agency will reach a majority voted decision. This would be a different case if we had voluntarily sought a remand and taken the case back, and then we could have made an administrative decision to solve the problem through majority vote, perhaps. But this court has to find a legal rationale for sending it back first. And under petitioner's theory of the case controls the standing analysis. Now,
Their theory of the case now, according to their 28J letter, includes the assertion that now it isn't a nullity. It will go back, and there is a majority, and you should not assume, you can't order FERC to take action, perhaps, but you shouldn't assume that FERC is so feckless and heedless of its public responsibility that having reached a deadlock and now being able to get past deadlock, it will refuse to do that. So send it back. I take it that that's a bit of what their letter of January 5th was meant to communicate.
I understand, Judge Jordan, but under their theory of the case, the remedy the court provides would still have to provide them redress. And the only way under their theory of the case they can get redress is if the commission issues a majority voted decision.
Right.
And that's not a dispute that this court can resolve.
We can't make FERC do it, but we can give it back to them in order to do it. In other words, you just said, hey, if we asked you to send it back without any legal rationale, you could send it back because we can ask you to send it back. And now what you're saying is, and that's okay. But you're at the same time saying, it's not even, they don't even have the standing because it's not redress to say to you, hey, you could send it back and give them another crack at it because you can't make them do it.
Is there a case that says redressability is the court remanding the case to a body without knowledge of what the body will do?
No, I don't know of a case where the court says that, because there has to be a basis for sending the case back. So if this were a case where a procedural injury case, where the petitioner said, you know, commission, you certified this dam, but you didn't consider all the comments, and the court could say, okay, we don't know if we send this back to you, you're still going to license the dam, but we can, there is a dispute we can resolve in telling you to consider the comments, because that's within our jurisdiction. Now, I would like to say, under our theory of the case, there certainly is a way that this court can give meaningful judicial review and either affirm or deny or reject the focus MOPR, because there is a meaningful commission order for the court to review and pretty consistent with Administrative Procedure Act principles governing judicial
Great.
Review.
Boy, so. I would love to hear how that works. Now, I'm expecting to hear a lot of what we saw in your brief. So maybe you could begin by telling us under what authority you take the assertion that the views of certain commissioners are the views of the agency.
Okay, can I ask before he does that?
Yes, you may.
This is an opinion you would give only if the other parties have standing, is that correct?
Right, if the other parties have standing because, say, they adopt our theory of 205G,
but
if they adopt
they
our theory of 205G, then they have standing. No question.
Give us your opinion.
Okay.
Give us your argument.
Right, so I think there's some confusion at the outset on what is the order here. The order is not the individual statements of the commissioners. The order is what Congress defined it to be. It is where there is a 2-2 tie, an inaction under the traditional definition of a commission order, that shall be an order of the commission accepting the filed rate.
Well, it is an order of the commission for purpose of reviewability. That's what the statute says. The statute's pretty clear. It says, the failure to issue an order accepting or denying the change by the commission shall be considered to be an order issued by the commission accepting the change for purposes of section 825 LA of this title.
Right.
There's not even a comma in there. It doesn't say it's an order for all purposes. It says it's an order for one purpose, for purposes of 825 LA, which, as I understand it, and as Mr. Shepard was hitting pretty hard, means it's an order solely for the purpose of allowing somebody to petition for rehearing. Right. Why does it not mean that?
I have three responses to that, Your Honor. First, the most reasonable interpretation of that phrase is that Congress wanted to make clear that the typical agency rehearing process would apply to a deadlock scenario. Second, an order for purposes of Section 825 LA is an order for purposes of meaningful judicial review. The order referenced in 825
exactly.
LA is the order that ultimately gets reviewed on the merits.
But you know, when we talk about order getting reviewed, I thought I learned that it was the whole record that got reviewed, not just an order.
Yes, that's correct. But the court's analysis has to be anchored in the rationale provided by the agency. And so here,
the question is, who's the agency, right?
So this is where I'm going to try to make it really simple. When the court typically reviews an order of the agency, what does it look to for the rationale? It looks to the rationale of those commissioners that voted for what is the institutional agency decision. Here we have the institutional agency decision. Congress said we do. It's acceptance of the filed rate in the case of a 2-2 tie. Where's the rationale for that? You look to the two commissioners that voted for what is the agency decision. That's contained here in the joint statement of the chairman.
So what you're really saying is PJM controls what FERC says. That's what you're saying. You're saying, it's absolutely what you're saying. Because what you're saying is, if whatever PJM says, whichever two people agree with that, that's the rule.
Well, but that's a function of Congress deciding that a 2-2 split is
and
good
can
enough.
Can Congress do that? Can Congress say, you know what? We're giving the force of law to this completely unaccountable private organization hanging out there. You know what? We cannot just delegate the power of this country to an agency that's got some kind of accountability to the U.S. public. We can delegate this through that agency to a completely unaccountable outfit, and they can say something, and if two people happen to agree with it and there's deadlock, that's the law of the land.
Your
Congress
Honor,
can do that?
No, there's no delegation past the agency.
How can you say that? That's exactly the effect, isn't it? I mean, how is it anything but that, Mr. Fish?
That's the effect only because two commissioners who are entrusted with making decisions on rate filings decided that it was lawful.
Two others said it isn't. Yeah. And the independent market monitor, who I guess has some, I don't know, I should ask you, do they have like, is that just like a put-up job? Do they get any kind of deference at all? I mean, do we pay the least attention to what that outfit says?
Well, as Judge Phipps said, you know, what the independent market monitor says in filings in the record are, you know, are part of the record that the court reviews. Here, however,
we don't really pay attention to them because when they say, this isn't just and reasonable, this makes no sense whatsoever, you'd be better off with no MOPR whatsoever than with the mess that's just been created. When they say that, they're to be ignored.
Well, there's an easy answer to that question in this case, Your Honor, because the market monitor did not file a rehearing application, and a party has to file a rehearing application for their objections to be considered by the court. So you can put the factual questions aside.
We can ignore it because they didn't take a step, even though it's in the record.
Right. But as far as the 2-2 issue, I mean, Congress created the commission. Congress decided that there would be five commissioners, a total complement of five commissioners. Congress decided that it's good enough if there are four commissioners. You know, what Congress giveth, it can taketh away, and there's nothing, there's no constitutional infirmity.
Let me just tease that out. Like, I'm pretty sure there's a case where live poultry codes that became law with zero vote. ALA Schechter is like one of the two cases, 1935. You may know it, non-delegation doctrine,
yes.
Right? Never guess non-delegation doctrine on multiple choice tests. It's always wrong, right?
I think
you want it to be today too, right? But it turns out though that, but there, if I recall right, what the Supreme Court said was, we can't delegate to a private party to set rates because there was zero agency action involved, right? No commissioners, nobody voted for it. They just said, whatever this private party does becomes the rate for chicken, I think. That was unconstitutional. Now, zero votes is unconstitutional. Here we've got 2-2 votes. We've got a tie vote. There's no delta. It's not 3-2 or anything like this. And so what you're saying is zero votes is unconstitutional. You can't argue that, right? That's 1935. Zero votes is unconstitutional. But 2-2, because Congress wanted 2-2 to be okay, is constitutional.
Your Honor, the logical endpoint of that proposition is truly revolutionary because under the Federal Power Act and the Natural Gas Act, going all the way back to 1935 and 1938, a utility gets to file a rate, and that rate takes effect with zero votes unless the commission rejects it or later in time, a party brings a Section 206 complaint against it. So that would really unravel the whole statutory scheme going back nearly 100 years.
So what you're saying is basically ALA Schechter was its own thing. It was live poultry codes. It was National Industrial Recovery Act. It wasn't Federal Power Act.
Well, we have to...
And surely if there was a problem with this regime under the Federal Power Act, it would have been recognized before 2023 by the Third Circuit.
Yes, I think so, Your Honor. I mean, this is the framework set forth in the Federal Power Act and Natural Gas Act has been considered by the Supreme Court many, many, many times over nearly 100 years. So, but I would say if there's no problem with allowing a rate to take automatic effect after 60 days, then why is there a constitutional problem with a 2-2 tie?
Good
right,
point.
There isn't. So we're back to just interpreting what the statute says. And the statute says we have an institutional order of the commission as Congress defined it. And how does the court always look at orders of an agency? It looks to the rationale of those commissioners that voted for that decision. So this really...
You only do that when they age, like... You're talking past each other, and it's no fault of yours. Maybe that the statute itself is unworkable, but you're not meeting their assertion head on, which is This is not the construct that Judge Phipps has discussed. This isn't a world in which each commissioner is an agency unto him or herself. This is a world in which the agency has to act as the agency, act qua agency. And as the D.C. Circuit has said in a number of circumstances, including in the Nextel case, you know, that's not an act of the agency. That's an act of Congress, right? In Nextel, they said, it's tied. That wasn't an act of the agency. The FCC didn't do that because the FCC didn't do anything because it was deadlocked. That was Congress saying, that's going to happen. And therefore, it happened. But it's not agency action. Why wouldn't
Congress created the agency, Congress determine how the agency votes.
Exactly. And one...
Before you go answer her question, answer my question.
Yes.
So answer me why Sprint, in saying that, the court with the most experience with administrative law said in a circumstance very similar to this, that is not agency action.
It's a very different circumstance, Your Honor,
because why?
Because in Sprint Nextel, under the FCC, under the FEC cases, Congress did not define a deadlock to be an agency order. It just said a deadlock is judicially reviewable. Here, Congress went the distance. It said, you have inaction, we're actually going to say that is an institutional order of the agency. And so unless you're willing to say that's unconstitutional...
So that depends on our accepting your assertion that when the statute says for purposes of Section 825 LA, it really doesn't mean for purposes of 825 LA. It means for all purposes, for all purposes. They could have said for all purposes, but they didn't.
Well, I'm not
What's
sure.
the purpose of saying this is it for purposes of 825 LA? In other words, for your opportunity to file a petition for rehearing. Is it just like they couldn't? They just narrowed it that way because they didn't know how to say for all purposes?
No, Your Honor. I think it was just to clarify that in this
unusual... they meant for all purposes.
Maybe, but you don't have to decide that here. What Congress most reasonably intended was to clarify that in this odd, counterintuitive circumstance, the typical, we're going to try to align this posture as closely as we can to the typical agency review posture, and we're going to clarify that the party that wants to seek review of this order of the commission, as Congress defined it, still has to go through the agency rehearing process. And if I could just take a step back and explain why E3 and EPSA's view of the statute in particular does render it a nullity. First, they argue, well, Congress just intended for to preserve everyone's rights.
I don't think you have to go there, okay. And here's why. Because the same endless loop argument that we were talking about a minute ago,
it wouldn't apply to our...
You go ahead and do that. I shouldn't interrupt you because I got two colleagues here. I read your brief, and I know your position on
right.
that.
Well, so if I could make 2 points. First of all, you wouldn't get the endless loop here under our theory because the court would review the focus MOPR on the merits and decide whether it survives arbitrary and capricious review. And if it doesn't, then sends it back to the commission with an order saying, here's the deficiencies, and maybe, you know, the commission will probably reach a majority decision, probably unanimous, if the court says, here are all the deficiencies with the two commissioners' views that voted for it.
Okay. Do we ever look back at what the commission itself has said to decide whether something is arbitrary and capricious?
What the commission itself has...
Yeah, you know... I was on the panel in the New Jersey Public Utilities case, and boy, are you singing a different song today than you were then. Man, 180 degrees different. Back then, you said things like the disruption of price signals forces FERC action, and that these things are disruptions in the market. We had no choice but to go forward. And now, FERC is saying, don't look over there.
Oh, actually, we are. No, we're saying do look over there. And so I have two responses to Your Honor's question. First, the focus MOPR is very much like what we call the legacy MOPR that this court approved back in 2014. The only difference is that that legacy MOPR applied price mitigation to new natural gas plants, but it exempted state-supported facilities that were not natural gas plants. It was the expanded MOPR that marked a radical change in how the price mitigation was applied. Now, the only real substantive difference is we're taking away the natural gas plant price mitigation.
Is there a point at which, honestly, is it in our purview? Is it right for us to look and say, this isn't reasoned, careful, thoughtful administrative action? In fact, if we pay attention to the one outfit that appears to have no axe to grind, the independent monitor, they say this thing's a mess. This is straight up politics. This is as raw as politics gets. This is just change in administration, a very, very different view on what should be prioritized. And so, you know, well, just and reasonable's got nothing to do with it. This is about a green energy agenda, which you can like or not like, you can think it's good or not good. You can come up with reasons why you should support it or not support it, but the reasons don't really matter because the reasons changed just like that. We went 180 and now only pay attention to one side of the argument because those two happen to have PJM behind them because they also happen to have PJM happened to have responded to Chairman Glick's statement to them. You fix this and change it the way we like it, or we're changing it for you. I mean, is there a point at which we pay attention to those sorts of things in the record and say, this isn't about just and reasonable rates. This is about political heft and power and who can wield it to the point where you say to the other side, you don't even have standing to talk about this anymore.
Well, first of all, they only don't have standing under their theory of the case. But the reality is, bringing this back to traditional APA principles, under Fox versus FCC, what the agency's burden is to first acknowledge a change in policy, and second, show good reasons why the new policy works. And that is a principle that this court expressly endorsed in the NGBPU decision. In fact, the court said, FERC, don't even need to show a change in circumstances for it to change your policy. You just need to provide good reasons for the new policy, and here we have, and I'm happy to go through all of them.
You don't have to, because you should not take anything I just said as saying, you know, I like one side or I don't like the other side. I'm just making the point that this just looks like a complete flopping around, which doesn't really have the sort of agency thoughtfulness behind it that we're accustomed to seeing. What it has behind it is a division, and a very sharp division, on two different on ways to look at what is sensible energy policy. And the only reason that this new narrowed MOPR is in effect is because Commissioner Glick said, change it, or we're doing it for you. So they changed it, and then when it came to deadlock, that's the thing that came to fruition. Not agency thoughtfulness, straight up, I'm telling you, do it.
Your Honor, there is something like 86 pages in the joint statement. There's a lot of agency thought went into acceptance of the focus MOPR here, respectfully.
I think what Judge Jordan is getting at is that maybe all that feels like post hoc rationalization.
Yeah, exactly. You're missing my point.
And it's a little strange for something that is supposed to be insulated, as independent agencies are supposed to be more insulated from the political ups and downs than administrative agencies. I think what he's saying is it just kind of feels like everyone made up their mind and then they supplied rationale for it. And maybe that's the way it works. Maybe we just say, okay, you can change your mind. I guess it is a democratically responsive theory of administrative law where we say you're allowed to change your mind as long as your basis for the change isn't arbitrary and capricious or unjust, unreasonable. And so maybe what you're saying is, hey, that's fine. Maybe you fight Judge Jordan and say, yeah, that's exactly what happened. Yeah. It's fine, because what we did is it still passes arbitrary capricious review.
It's not post hoc, Judge Phipps, because the rationale is provided in what Congress defined to be the order of the commission. So it's not post hoc. And the beauty of the APA is you don't need to peel back the curtain and try to figure out what the politics were, what the give and take was, because the question is whether in the decision of the agency there is a reasonable explanation.
There you go. Right. When you say in the decision of the agency, that's the fight we're having. And that's what makes me wonder, is this even constitutional? Is it constitutional? Can Congress declare that where the agency doesn't act because they have no majority, it will be deemed to have acted?
Well, the only reason, this is all at Congress's, Congress created all of this. Congress only decided that this was inaction because it defined a typical agency action in Section 7171E of the Department of Energy Organization Act as a majority voted decision. It didn't have to.
So there's nothing that says. It could have done what Judge Phipps said. It could have said, we will do this on a random basis. Every other order that comes out can be decided by one commissioner. They'll draw lots, and that'll be who gets to decide.
No, Judge Jordan. That's not what I'm saying, and this is really important. There is the order of the commission, and then there's the rationale for that. The statements are not orders of the commission. Each commissioner is not an agency unto himself.
You've missed my point, and I apologize for being inarticulate, and this won't go on forever. But
it can. I'm
understand
sure.
Your position to be, Congress can declare anything to be agency action. So if it wanted to, it could write a statute that said the agency will draw, members of the commission will draw lots, and whoever the lot falls on will speak for the agency, and that will have the force of law. And Congress could do that.
I don't think, but here
you have a certain thing that Congress has said, which none of the parties is saying is unconstitutional. And since that is the case, should we not then, because Congress created the agency, say that Congress can determine within the bounds of rationality how the agency acts?
Yes, exactly, Judge Roth.
Thank you. That's the bounds of rationality. That's what I'm asking. You're saying it's within the bounds of rationality for Congress to say deadlock is not deadlock. It's whatever the private entity said the two people liked. They can, because that's what happened.
But that's really important. The two people liked it. I mean, consider if we had
Why is that better than fall by lot? It's whoever gets the lot. We got four people left.
Well, because that's not what Congress said. We are dealing with what Congress said this time. And since no one is saying it's unconstitutional, since Congress created the agency, we are determining what action has been taken by the agency under the ground rule set out by Congress.
Yes.
You can just say, yeah, I agree.
I agree.
I'll take that as your answer.
Sorry.
All right.
Sorry,
good enough. We've had you up there for an awful long time, Mr.
Could I just add a real quick footnote since standing came up? We also don't think that the states show redressability because the remedy they request is not something the court can grant. The court cannot vacate the focus MOPR itself. It only reviews orders of the commission. And in the reply brief, they say, well, the court could order FERC to open a 206 proceeding. There's no case law to support that the court can superintend what.
What you're really saying is nobody can ever question this.
Under our theory of the case, any complaint.
Your theory of the case is this is an order and we win.
It kind of confuses redressability with remedy. At least they're blur. It seems to suggest that you're saying, hey, look, some of the remedies that they're asking for don't satisfy redressability. But really, I think what you're saying is the reason they don't satisfy redressability is because there's a statutory basis for those remedies. And so then I don't really know which kind of comes first. Is that a redressability problem, or is that an absence of statutory authority for the remedy problem?
Well, I suppose you could think of it in terms of statutory standing or prudential standing in that way. I mean,
that's not in vogue. That's not too in vogue these days.
Well, but Congress, I mean, Congress was clear. I mean, Congress confers the power of judicial review under statutes. And Congress said this court's review extends to orders of the commission. Well, P3 and EFSA say there's no real order of the commission here. So where does the court get its review? And the states say the same thing. They say there's no real order of the commission. So just, throw up your hands and do de novo review.
Your theory is they've got standing if they accept your premise. They don't have standing if they don't.
They don't have standing.
That's just what you said.
They don't have standing under their theories of the case. I don't know if there's another theory besides ours that would get them.
I mean, but they do have standing to challenge the unconstitutionality of 205G, right?
Well, they haven't. I mean.
No. Fair. But if they did, they would have standing. They just don't have standing because they want something that's not really available to them, right?
I think that's a better. Yeah, I think that's a better way. Of putting it.
So your standing argument is really just a responsive point. It's not that no one has standing. It's just that these requests on this type of relief, it can't be redressed by a favorable decision.
Right, because standing is viewed through the lens of the petitioner's theory of the case. So if you accept our theory of the case, yeah, lots of people can. Just as in the typical case where an aggrieved party seeks judicial review of an agency order. And so I would just close by saying this, the framework that Congress set up here is not perfect. I will cop to that. But it is a lot closer to being amenable to typical APA review procedures than I think it might appear at first blush, and I hope I've explained why.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Thank you for your argument today, Mr. Fish. We'll hear from Mr. Price on behalf of several of the intervener respondents.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm at the podium today representing PJM and the supporting interveners that were on that brief with PJM. And if I may, I'd like to start with the question the argument began with however long ago. Should we just remand to FERC? And then after that, I'd like to talk about the constitutionality issue and how this is supposed to work. And then last, I'd like to address the questions, Judge Jordan, that you asked about NJBPU and the flip-flop discussion that you had with Mr. Fish. So the first question on, can the court just remand? The answer is no, it can't. And there are 5 points I'd like to make about that. The first is that it's not the court's role to speculate about outcomes. So
don't have to speculate about outcomes. All we have to speculate, it's not speculation. If it's in fact true that there are three commissioners, there will be a majority decision.
Well, we don't know that because by the time the case gets back there, the Senate could confirm another commissioner. We could be back to a 2-2 deadlock. Commissioner Phillips could decide he's not recused after all. He could vote. It could be a 2-2 deadlock. We don't know. And it's
I
not
thought there were four commissioners and one said he was recused.
Currently, never said he was recused. He just didn't participate before. And again, there's an empty seat that could be filled. So I think the court shouldn't be speculating on what an agency might do if it gets a case back. Its job is to determine whether there's been error. And that's what justifies remand. Okay, so that's the first question, first point. The second point is that's what Congress wanted you to do. Look, is there an error that justifies remand when it said that non-action is deemed an order accepting the change? That was Congress's word. So it wanted you to take this non-action as acceptance and then review that. The third point is—
Review it how?
Yeah, go ahead.
Review it how?
Believe me, I will talk at length about that, but if I could just make one more point about—
Maybe not at length.
Fair enough. The other, just very briefly, points I want to make about the remand is that it's important for the court to remember it has no power to actually force FERC to do anything on remand. And if you read the public citizen case, it explains that FERC action is entirely discretionary.
Gotcha.
And then the last point about that is, they could solve this entire problem today just by filing a new Section 206 application. It's within their power to file a complaint, and that would tee up the issue for FERC to decide. And if they really think there's only three votes, then let them file a Section 206 application. That's the easy way out for them to tee it up for a new majority rule, if that's what they want to do. But apparently they would rather not do that for some reason. Now, turning to the constitutionality and how this works. I want to begin with a point, a statement you made, Judge Jordan, about how PJM controls what FERC says. And Mr. Fish talked a little bit about this, but it's really vitally important to understand the backdrop of how Section 205 works under the Federal Power Act. A utility like PJM gets to file a tariff, and if FERC does nothing, which it can do, the tariff goes into effect by operation of law. That's not a delegation of power. It's simply a private entity gets to state a tariff, and the tariff goes into effect by operation of law. Section 205 gives FERC an opportunity, 60 days, to say, hey, wait a second, we want to investigate that because we're concerned that it might not be just and reasonable. And if FERC doesn't act, the tariff goes into effect. And Section 206, anytime FERC can say, hey, we don't like this tariff, we think it's unjust and unreasonable, and we're going to investigate it. So that's a vitally important point that informs, really, I think, the constitutional analysis and also the statutory analysis. The problem that the Congress was trying to solve in public was recognized by Public Citizen, which is the utility filed a tariff, FERC couldn't reach a decision, so it didn't take action, the tariff went into effect. And people were concerned that seems unfair. So okay. We want to create an avenue for judicial review in that instance.
You're saying that PJM can file a tariff, and if FERC does nothing, the tariff continues. How did FERC then get into this picture?
Well, because FERC attempted to vote on the tariff PJM filed.
So it decided to review it?
It decided to try to review it. And it received all sorts of comments, and then it deadlocked. That's right. But I think one of the...
So they saw something worth reviewing.
They saw something worth reviewing because it attracted a lot of protests, right? A lot of people were upset about it, so they saw something worth reviewing. It was a change.
Pretty
dramatic. Well, all tariffs are changes,
Your
Honor.
Well, not a minor change. Pretty dramatic change, right?
That's absolutely right. Yeah, it was a big change.
Pretty dramatic change 2 years before.
That's exactly right.
It's going back to the way it used to be.
Correct. So if this is a flip, it's following a flop, right? I mean, what happened in 2018 was a major... That's right. That was the flip, and this is the flop, you might say, Your Honor.
When an agency explains the basis for a series of changes, does it have to account at all for the duration and the time in effect that the prior change was there? So if something was in effect for 70 years and you want to change it, should you account for that 70-year period? The reliance interests are stronger at that point in time. If you're flipping every 2 years at one level, maybe then the reliance interest can't be that strong because of the rate of flip. But at the same time, it might be harder to explain why you're changing every 2 years unless you've got really, really, really good reasons for each one of those changes because you're changing a lot.
Well, here, Your Honor, there's been a big change. And the answer is yes, of course, length of time does matter for reliance. It's just something that's been around for 70 years incurs greater reliance interest, most likely, than something that's been around for two. And I would say that if you look at the evidence that supports the reliance argument, it's pretty thin. I mean, they don't really articulate how any investment they really made in reliance on a rule that was 2 years old that was in litigation from the moment it was enacted. But I think it's important to understand that the 2018 rule that they want to go back to, I mean, that was a sea change that had never been done before in terms of saying every subsidy warrants some sort of administrative repricing. And this just goes back to the way things were, and for good reason. There was evidence in the record about why.
It just goes back. When I read Commissioner Danley's report, he seems to say this isn't the way it was before, that there were a whole series of things where the commission was endeavoring to do price mitigation to address state subsidies because they are, as FERC once upon a time said to me, not 2 years ago, but a lot longer ago than that, I can't remember what it is, but like 10 years plus, that when you mess with the price signals in the market, it's a bad thing. I mean, that's the position he took and articulated. I understand others took a different view, but is it accurate to say that this thing just like blew up out of no place in 2018, or was this in fact the culmination of a series of changes over time that recognized there should be price mitigation to address the buyer side power when you got states coming into the market with their own energy policy decisions and affecting the entire region, in effect forcing their policy choices on everybody else because they're underbidding the market. They are indeed disrupting the price signal. Well, I guess that's a long question, the seed of it is it really fair to say, boy, this is out of no place in 2018?
Well, a couple of answers, Your Honor, and I'm glad you asked the question because I want to clarify. We didn't, the new rules aren't actually just going back to the way they were. There are changes that expand the application. I can talk about those in a moment. But the idea that a subsidy, a state support, is an exercise of buyer-side market power, vel non, that is a new concept in 2018. In the 2011 case that Your Honor was on, New Jersey Board of Public Utilities, what the commission did there and what PJM did there was remove an exemption that state-supported resources had enjoyed, right? And they said, just because you're supported by a state, we're going to treat you like everybody else. If you're exercising market power, understood in the sense of trying to manipulate the prices in the market by underbidding your economic costs, then we're going to mitigate you.
Well, and the matter of pure economics, doesn't any subsidy disrupt the price signal by definition?
Well, no, I would say no, Your Honor. And
I'm not talking about law. I'm not talking about policy. I'm not talking about, is it a good idea or a bad idea? Should we be subsidizing this kind of energy or that kind of energy? This is a pure matter of, you know, price theory, you know, Econ 101 stuff. If you subsidize, you have disrupted the price. You have disrupted the price signal by definition, because it's no longer a freely operating market in which, you know, you posit rational actors with full information. It's now a market in which rational actors with full information also have some different pressure from outside the system coming in. That's, am I just confused about economics? Because I could be.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I mean, we're all lawyers, not economists, but there was evidence in the record by many economists, eminent economists, I might add, which cited economic textbooks, which explained that when, for example, you have an externality, that is, for example, pollution, yeah, that isn't being taxed, a subsidy is an appropriate way to deal with that, that doesn't distort the market, but actually creates more appropriate pricing to recognize the entire social impact of what your production is doing.
Okay, so you've now just added a different thing in, which is you've said there's an externality that has to be addressed. That's different from the hypothetical.
There are a lot of externalities that have to be addressed.
So you're,
and FERC does not address state policy, but it does affect the, it does address the effect that those externalities can have on competition. Is that correct?
Well, what I would say is there are a lot of externalities. States do all sorts of things to encourage new generation, to limit the kinds of plants that can be built in their boundaries, to impose environmental limitations, to subsidize natural gas. They do all sorts of things. And that's, they can do that. That's within their power to do. And what FERC was, what PJM was saying in this filing is, we shouldn't be, FERC shouldn't be in the business of picking and choosing which state programs we should try to reverse and which we shouldn't. That's what states just simply act. The two spheres of federal and state are not hermetically sealed. What happens, one affects the other. And
yeah, but that's not a statement about economics, so maybe I should just get off here. That's a statement that the Supreme Court made in Hughes, and that the DC Circuit is repeated, and the Seventh Circuit is repeated, that we live in. But the reality is, you, Congress created a system that inherently has tension in it, and the tension exists because when a state subsidizes something, which it's allowed to do, it does disrupt the price signal, and we just accept it. That's the way I thought it was happening.
I guess I just don't agree that every subsidy is distortionary. I think there, and the record establishes that there are some subsidies, for example, to subsidize non-emitting plants that are not distortionary.
Oh,
so that's the economic
they
point.
They are. Gotcha. That when you've got negative externalities, you can do something to price into the market how to manage that.
That's right, and that's what states are trying to accomplish. The other thing I want to point out is that there was new evidence
that's
here.
That's what you're saying they're trying to accomplish, and that's not within our purview. But what the other side seems to be saying is that may not be what they're trying to accomplish. They got their own interests, and their own interests are, we take care of our own, and we don't care what it does to anybody else. That seems to be, you know, some of the argument that we're getting here. But
and the question for the court on the merits is there a reasonable choice for FERC to say, you know what, we're not going to get in the business of trying to solve that problem. States will do what they want to do, as they can do under the Federal Power Act, and we're going to run our market and just take as a background what states do. And that's all FERC did here. And that's an entirely reasonable choice to for FERC to make. And it's a reasonable policy for FERC to change to based on...
FERC could take the position that we're never going to get. There's, short of the use situation, there's nothing the state could do that would prompt FERC to act. So when FERC said back then in 2011 that, you know, we're forced to act when there's a disruption to the price signal. There's nothing the states could do that would prompt FERC to say, that's too far, that's a bridge too far.
I mean, maybe there's something that's a bridge too far, but the evidence here, Your Honor, that is pointed to in this joint statement talked about how the reason for the decision to go back to a system of not mitigating all subsidies, states expanded their programs despite the fact that FERC had been mitigating them, and that created a problem of over-procurement in the market that cost customers billions of dollars a year. That's the evidence that the joint statement relied on, and the reason for that is if you mitigate all of these other these state-supported resources, effectively pretending they don't exist when you're getting your capacity, well, then they actually do exist, and they actually provide capacity, and so all of a sudden you have a lot more capacity than you really need, and customers are paying in the capacity market for capacity they don't actually need, and FERC, the joint statement says that that's going to be billions of dollars a year for consumers, that's unnecessary cost.
So your argument is essentially Mr. Fish's argument, which is pay attention to the joint statement.
Well, that's right. And I think that, I mean, I know that there's
ignore, been... Ignore what Commissioner Danley said. Ignore what the independent market monitor said. Ignore Commissioner Christie. Ignore those other people, because that just doesn't matter. Okay. What matters is what these two commissioners like, what they think, what their view of the world is. That's what counts for agency action and rationale.
No, I'm not saying ignore them, Your Honor. I mean, anytime you have a dissent, it's relevant, and evidence in the record is relevant. But in terms of what your task is, you have a deemed order by the commission that accepts this tariff. And the question is, is there substantial evidence in the record supporting that outcome? And is there a reasoned basis supporting that outcome?
I mean, it seems that Judge Jordan's asking you, are you taking the same position on this kind of 205 issue as FERC is? And I think you are.
I think we're on the same side of the brief.
I think what you're saying is that the petitioners, the position of the commissioners in favor of the controlling order becomes the agency decision that we primarily evaluate for purposes of defending that order in litigation. We look to what the other commissioners say just to make sure that they didn't miss something along the way and that it's a whole record review. But in essence, what you're saying is we got this order. Feels weird that we've got this order, right? Because it's deadlock produces an order. But then the one kind of unspoken point that seems to be like maybe the keystone to your point, because you got the statute that says the order becomes, you know, the order becomes as a result of an action, the position of the agency. The one unspoken point seems to be that when we have that, we look to the commissioners, to the commissioners who voted in favor of that order, that becomes the position of the agency for purposes of defending it on reconsideration, and reconsideration is a precursor to judicial review. That you're in lockstep with FERC, right?
Well, I agree.
Or if I've got that right.
I mean, the FEC cases say exactly that. Since those commissioners constituting a controlling group for purposes of their decision, their rationale necessarily states the agency's reasons for acting as it did, and then the D.C. Circuit, when it's faced with deadlock cases, goes on and reviews the statement of the commissioners that supported the outcome as the reason of the agency, because that's what resulted in the agency's decision.
But
there's no new ground here, really.
I mean, the trick is, it might not be new from a precedental point, but it's new from it's a little bit atextual.
I don't think it's atextual, Your Honor. I mean, I think the point of...
Where's the basis in... So that seems to be the keystone of the case, right? At least the first issue in the case. And so what's the textual basis for that?
Well, I think the textual basis is you have an order, right? The
statute right. says
order accepting. And then the question under, really, it's rooted in a Chenery separation of powers concept.
But keep going.
Can the court discern the agency's path so that it can review what the agency did? That's the question of agency reviewability.
And the question is, it really can't, if they're saying two different things and everything's given equal weight, but it can if we look at only the ones in support of the order, then it's all doable.
And that's what the D.C. Circuit has done in the FEC case and the FCC case.
But what's missing from the statute would be to say, I mean, we wouldn't be here on the 205G issue if the statute said, oh, and by the way, the order is final. And when you want to look at the, when you want to perform the arbitrary and capricious review, look to the votes of the commissioner that support, that are behind the order. If the statute said that, then a lot of the dispute goes away. It doesn't say that. Mm-hmm. You're asking us to make that inference. I've posited other inferences that maybe we look to each individual commissioner or we do something else like that because we're in a statutory absent, a place of absent statutory direction. And what you're saying is that just this is how it's always done, and because that's how the D.C. Circuit always does it, that's a good idea.
Well, a couple things. First, I think it's important to remember in the FEC context, the statute doesn't say that either. The court, in fact, created the doctrine itself.
The second point context, is the FEC and the D.C. Circuit seem to go out of its way to make this point in Public Citizen, I think. That's a completely different structure for that statute, and usually it was, indeed, the FEC is set up in a way to make deadlock a regular thing, and when there is deadlock, it usually is a preservation of the status quo, not a radical change of the status quo. Here you're talking about a deadlock where it's not a preservation of the status quo, it is a radical change of the status quo. So, well, what does that do to your FEC argument? Well, when the D.C. Circuit itself says, hey, that's a real different statute, don't pay attention to that.
Well, a couple of things, Your Honor. First of all, the deadlock isn't what created a change in the status quo. It's the filing of the tariff that would have gone into effect anyway that created a change in the status quo. I think that's an important point. I don't want to lose it. Well, but as to the FEC...
Don't lose it, because we've already discussed that if FERC had done nothing, we would definitely not be here.
That's right.
But FERC chose to do something, so we are here. So please don't take us into the counterfactual world of what would have happened if they hadn't done something. They did. But go ahead.
Okay. With respect to the FEC, the reason why Public Citizen said the FEC cases were different is because at that time 205G wasn't enacted, and so there was no basis for concluding that agency inaction should be deemed an action. That's the problem Congress was trying to solve in enacting 205G. And Congress, I mean, knew that it was reacting expressly to the Public Citizen decision, indeed, which distinguished the FEC cases, and I think the rational thing to conclude looking at that is Congress was trying to adopt into the FPA the very path that the D.C. Circuit had trod many times in the FEC context when there would be a deadlock under the FPA. And that, once you recognize that, it's actually a very straightforward thing that should happen here. You should simply review the decision under the ordinary approach of administrative law. Is there substantial evidence? Is there arbitrary and capriciousness? With using, as the FEC cases say, the decision of the controlling commissioners as the basis for the agency's action.
All right. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time. Here from Mr. Strauss. Conscious that we've been here for 2 hours, so I may hold you a little tighter leash than other people, Mr. Strauss.
I'll try to speak clearly and concisely, Your Honor. Yeah. Good evening. May it please the court, Scott Strauss for the state entity interveners. A while back, Judge Jordan, you said you'd read a lot about how this was beautifully designed. And it is beautifully designed, and I thought I'd spend a few minutes talking to you about that. I know we spent most of the time talking about 205G. I'd only say that if you decide that 205G is unconstitutional, then we're gone. This case is over, because they have no right to appeal.
We can't do that because no one has presented that argument.
Fair enough. Just to cover that point for 30 seconds, the Federal Power Act allows utilities to set rates in the first instance. That's how it happens under the law. The Federal Power Act is essentially a notice provision. Utilities tell the agency, these are our new rates, and the agency gets 60 days to decide if they want to do something about it. They choose not to do anything about it. It simply goes into effect. There's no right of review. That's the end of that. Somebody doesn't like it afterwards, they're not without a right. They can file a complaint under 206 and attempt to show that it's unjust and unreasonable. That's how it works. 205G was an effort by Congress to say, look, if there's a deadlock, let's see whether or not we can't get judicial review of the deadlock, to add a layer of judicial review that isn't there ordinarily. And they allowed for commissioner statements to say, look, we need a record. What do you need to review an order? You need an order. You need a record supporting the order, and you need a standard of review. Those are the things the court needs to look at. So the Congress said, okay, Let's have statements to show what the record is that supports what happens. And what Congress wanted was that the rate would be accepted and put into place when there was a deadlock. So it only makes sense that in trying to decide whether or not the order was just and reasonable, you would look in the first instance to the statements of those who supported the acceptance. That would be the sensible thing to do. Doesn't mean you ignore the other any more than you'd ignore a dissent in a case. You obviously look to those things as well. But you would look first in the first instance to the statements in support. Now, I want to also point out that in this case, there's been some discussion about PJM having certain kinds of rights and deciding things. PJM has a unilateral right to file a rate change. They're a public utility. That's the right they have under the Federal Power Act. But they didn't do that alone and in a vacuum. They had a stakeholder process in which all of the market participants who have interest in this had an opportunity to participate, and they take a vote at the end of that. There are five voting sectors. 83.5% of the stakeholders voted in favor of the Focus MOPR. The majority of every one of the sectors voted in favor of it, including the generator sector.
Now, what are we to make, if anything, of the independent market monitor? Is that something that just is like, that's a throwaway, that's a nothing?
No, his views are obviously views that have to be considered as well. But to be clear, there is a market mitigation structure in this tariff. He apparently doesn't think it's adequate. The market participants, who presumably have a great deal of interest in having an adequate market mitigation structure, think it's just fine.
What's the point of having the independent market monitor?
He will be able to exercise a level of review and check on bids as they are made into the market, and if folks think that there are some...
But it's legally irrelevant is what you're saying. It has nothing to do with us. That's for PJM to think about. That's for FERC to think about. But when it gets to us, forget him. I don't mean to sound flip about it, but it's not legally relevant is what you're saying.
I don't know that it's not legally relevant, but it's not the only relevant thing, and his choice is not the one that dictates what necessarily happens. He had a view, he expressed it, the stakeholders considered it, and they didn't vote in favor of it. Okay. And in New York and New England, two other regions where there are an appropriate number of commissioners to be able to vote, FERC has voted in each case to address MOPR reform in ways that are similar to the Focus MOPR and PJM. So that does seem to be the agency view, and presumably would be the agency view in this case had they had the appropriate complement of commissioners. Now, I just want to address briefly, the generator's claim is that FERC is obligated to nullify state actions that affect the wholesale market, and that obligation doesn't exist. And there's a good reason for it. This is a multi-state wholesale market. States control decisions about generation and about electricity sales at the retail level. It is inevitable. Every choice that a state makes will have an effect on the wholesale market when you have a wholesale market.
Understood.
Well, okay, fair enough.
That's Hughes. We're with it.
Great. The Focus MOPR reflects statutory and marketplace realities. Whether your decision is to subsidize green energy or to tax pollution or to promote fracking, to promote fossil fuel use, whatever choice a state may make, one way or the other, it's going to have an impact. We're all in this together. It's a regional market. All of those decisions get accumulated into the price results in the auction. That's how it works. And there's likely nothing to the claim that this threatens competition. Competitors come to the market with various advantages. They sell different products and services. Some of them sell reliability services. Some of them sell other kinds of ancillary services. Clean resources sell clean energy attributes, which is a characteristic of production that some states in the PJM region look to support. Now, each revenue stream that is produced by the service or the product that the generator sells will reduce what they need to cover from the capacity market. It's just sensible. If you're getting the money from someplace else, you don't need to bid it into the capacity market. There's nothing anti-competitive or distortionist about that. That's just sensible. It's actually the other way around. If you didn't take the subsidies into account, then you would be distorting the market. And that's exactly what happened here. The generators are rewriting history when they're telling you that clean energy subsidies are something illegitimate, as if they're unique and showed up 2 hours ago. They've been a part of the industry forever. The joint statement and the joint appendix at page 69, footnote 123, says that since 1950, the federal government has provided $1 trillion in energy subsidies, 65% of which, $650 billion, have gone to fossil fuel technologies. Now, it would be impossible and unworkable for the federal agency to attempt to root out all of these myriad impacts from these things. It just wouldn't work. And PJM, and even more important, its stakeholders, and effectively the FERC under 205G, now realize that this does more harm to consumers and more harm to the market than the opposite.
Okay.
Okay? You know that.
Get it? Yeah, I got you. So I'll give you a minute to wrap up. All
right? Very well. Look, the joint statement strikes the right balance. It harmonizes federal and state authority. And it does what the purpose of the auction is. Let's not lose sight of that. The purpose of it is to ensure reliability at the lowest reasonable cost. That's the idea. And that's what's happening here. PJM believes that. The experts who support PJM believe that. The stakeholders who voted believe that. And look, in the final analysis, it should not be a problem that customers are getting reliable service at lower reasonable rates. That should not be something as a subject for judicial consternation or or intervention.
I understand your position. Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank Stiles. You, Your Honor.
We've got just a few minutes, and this time I think we'll kind of stick close to it. You've got a little bit of time for rebuttal. Mr. Shepherd, I believe you reserved some time, and I think Mr. Brown did too.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to first go to this question about zero votes versus versus operation of law, something that we've begun to discuss and I forgot to complete the loop on. There are public utilities and there are public utilities. If you're a public utility, at the time the statute was passed, you own something. It is true that that PJM is an RTO, but it's a nonprofit. It is no skin in the game. The doctrine that developed initially with the idea that you're filing a rate, it's your rate, it's your money, these are your customers. You file something, they don't protest. Does FERC really need to spend a lot of time writing an order? Does it actually need to hold a vote? If you file something, your customers don't protest, and after 60 days, there's no independent reason to find there's a problem. FERC overwhelmingly deals with business in uncontested matters that way. If you want the list of the times it's ever gone differently, oh shoot, I just lost my beautiful little list of nine times, six of which have happened since 205G, that FERC has gone to a contested matter and try to do something about a vote. That's a whole different planet, because that's when we get to public citizens.
Why don't you answer the point that I believe Mr. Price made, which is, look, if these guys have a beef, they've got a route. They can go in or they can file their complaint under 206, and they'll be heard.
Your Honor, that's my next point. Thank you very much for asking that question. That completely will not work. The first thing you have to do in a 206 case is you have to demonstrate that the existing rate is not just reasonable. It's step one. Step two, there's a proposal, and then FERC takes on the burden of doing the replacement rate. What's the rate that's in effect right now? We won't know the answer to that question until the court decides this case. And FERC is still trying to keep the original expanded MOPR orders in abeyance in the Seventh Circuit and the ludicrous proposition that somehow orders, you know, decided years ago in previous auctions are somehow dependent on the outcome of this case to determine whether or not those rules, those orders were lawful. What's the rate right now? So that's the first problem. The second problem is that it also assigns us a greater burden once we go that direction. When we have another, much more clear route, which is to just try to win this case. And maybe now that the commission has changed composition, I don't know, maybe P3 or EPSA will decide they want to file a complaint. But it's another important thing about complaints. Complaints are hardly a path to getting relief. The complaint that was just represented to you as an OG whiz, this didn't exist until 2018, that complaint was filed in 2016. And FERC just sat on it until finally the act in 2018.
Answer the redressability issue here, because what it sounds like you're doing is making Mr. Fish's argument for him, which is, hey, we don't have to do anything, and you can't make us. So any order you give that's of the character that Mr. Shepherd's client wants is a nullity, because you don't have the power to make FERC do anything. You can't, you could send it back to them, sure, but they don't have to do anything.
Your Honor, that argues too much. We've been involved in two different disputes here. One is this very new set of questions about how 205G works. The other set of questions would be what comes up in a traditional case. Really? If the position that he's arguing today were true, then you would never have the power, no court would ever have the power to vacate and remand a FERC decision, because they could never guarantee what the result would be in the back end. It must be sufficient relief. This goes to a question that Judge Roth wanted to pursue, which was my next point, which is you asked this question about, where's a case that says that just the fact that you're getting the case sent back is enough. The overwhelming majority of FERC cases that get remanded, and they are very frequently remanded, the debate is not about whether or not the court has the power to send it back. The debate is about whether or not it's such a bad decision that vacatur is required, or whether that will cause this disruption, or whether or not we're just sending it back for a more complete explanation to make it more APA compliant. You can't live in a world where that is the constant dialogue unless it is concretely understood that courts do have the power to send things back, and that it is, in fact, a remedy to give us another chance. You throwing me lifesavers, that's not the right name, life preserver, if I'm out drowning in the ocean, that gives me a chance to swim a little bit longer, is relief. It doesn't matter whether or not the next wave is gonna drown me, I'm still alive, and I'm still getting something else. So yes, just remand or just vacature are both lifelines for us. They're very valuable. I do not think standing should be. Are there any cases that still hold? I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Are there any cases that hold that remand without any idea of what the agency to which the case is being remanded will do is sufficient to provide redressability?
Your Honor, I've never heard of a case that said that. What I'm trying to explain is that
every remand
that is at stake in every remand. You never know what is going to happen on the remand. Do you need to know what the agency is going to do if you're remanded?
You may not know what the agency is going to do, but if you're going to remand, you have to be doing it because you've got a legal reason to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, hey, the rationale you provided was legally deficient under the APA.
That's the question you keep harking on, Your Honor, and that didn't mean it to be pejorative. The question you are appropriately focusing on is, what is it that we say if we're going to vacate or remand? And the answer is totally non-compliant with the APA, as Congress was warned in advance. And even if you could soup something out of this crazy idea that we're going to treat the separate statements as if they were orders, nothing fixes the APA problem. And now back again to you, Judge Roth, because you pursued another question about specificity, and I think this really needs to be closed out. You've raised the question, well, isn't the fact that 205, and it's really two doctrines, because you mentioned specificity, but there's also timeliness, right? 205G is later in time. 205G is also more specific about its facts. So shouldn't that set aside the APA? Well, I hear you, but I'll trump you, major questions doctrine. There is no way that you are going to pass a statute like that and surreptitiously decide that the APA does not apply. That is not the kind of thing that Congress would enact, or that if Congress had chosen to enact it with that intent, then any court would accept under the major questions doctrine.
So you're saying we have to decide either that Section 205G is ineffective, or that the APA trumps Section 205G, whether it's effective or not.
I think that the only decision here is the APA. The APA trumps 205G. I understand with, I think, even a greater level of frustration than this court does, how unappealing the idea of the infinite loop, as you've chosen to describe it, or the Groundhog Day. And those are apt descriptions of how that statute would operate.
Well, but it isn't an apt description if you accept the argument that's being made by the other side. The argument being made by the other side is Congress understood what it was doing, and whether they like it or not, they have effectively delegated the rationale making function to the winning side. That is the side in support of the tariff. That's not an illogical way to look at this. It's a savings way to look at this.
Mm.
It moves you past all the concerns you've got about major question doctrine or constitutionality. You just look at it and you say, we've got a record, we've got an order, we got a record, we got a standard of review, as Mr. Price walked us through it. That's the way you handle this. And you know what? They do live to fight another day, because as soon as you decide this thing, if it goes against them, you didn't say this, but sure as shooting, that's when they'll file their 206 complaint and it'll go on up. So what's wrong with that reasoning? Why isn't that a perfectly sensible way for this court to manage this? I mean, we've been at it for now over 2 hours, almost two and a half, going on two and a half. Why isn't, after all the talk, all the paper, gigantic volumes of paper, why isn't that the straightforward, sensible path to addressing this, what you've kind of described, not in these words, but as the Gordian knot?
There are a number of answers to that, and I'm sensing that you don't want to hear all of them. Let me give you the best one.
Good.
That the intent of public citizen would be entirely turned upside down. So the intent of 205G was to reverse public citizen. What's just happened, if you go that direction, is that Congress, in a attempt to reverse what happened in public citizen, will have mistakenly, through bad drafting, written a result that accomplishes exactly what public citizen was designed to overwhelm. It doesn't work. There was a record in public citizen, there was no order in public citizen, and on this subject, just for nomenclature, there's, I think, some loose use of order or non-order. I think the right way to describe this is the target is the notice, which is not an order. It's just an action. And it is a reviewable form of agency activity. But that's not the same thing as calling it an order. I'm sorry that Congress decided to inflict an infinite loop on this court. I'm sure that it is quite frustrating, but the only way to prevent the damage that's already occurred in the market and to preserve all parties' rights to a fair fight in the future is to reverse the notice, vacate it.
Okay.
Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Shepard. All right. I'll give the last word here to Mr. Brown.
Yes, Your Honor, I'll try to spare the court and not use up the full 2 minutes. I just want to address some of the merits issues that were raised. As far as your question, Your Honor, about the IMM, the IMM doesn't just speak to this in the record. He actually has a role in reviewing the bids to determine whether there is market power or not. So, and he's saying that he has a difficulty implementing that rule to be able to do his function.
Yeah, but
as part
Mr.
of that.
Strauss looked at that at the podium when I asked about that. He said he's got a role. He played his role. There's a conferring process, and that view was not the one that carried the day. So,
but that's
what more is to be said than that?
That's the role of designing the MOPR, designing the rule. Like I said, the rule is designed. He has a role in the rule to review the bids to determine if there's market power. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. Well, I don't know that we set a record, but it was an awful long argument. We appreciate everybody being here. Appreciate counsel sharing your insights with us and fielding the questions. It's a challenging case. We've got it under advisement. We'll try to get back to you as quickly as we can. All right?